It is Friday, and you know what that means. You've survived another week of the Trump administration. Congratulations to you. Take yourself out tonight. Do something nice, because we've all had enough brain damage this week. We'll be talking about that and the latest stuff and the ways that people are fighting back. We'll get into that about a big lawsuit that was filed today on the show. Also, we've got Ralph Nader as a guest today. Yeah, that Ralph Nader. He is going to have a show here on AM 950, so we get to chat with him for a few minutes today. And if you've got some thoughts on questions, just email them to me right now at comment@am950radio.com. I mentioned this at the end of the show yesterday. We got a few. Love to have your questions. We'll try to work them in. Probably not over the phone because we don't have a lot of time with Mr. Nader, but we'll try to get your questions in if you can get them to us. Also, got an interesting story I want to get into. Usually we talk about environmentalists and mining companies just kind of being at odds, especially when we look at the 8th Congressional District in Minnesota. Well, we've got a story from Wisconsin where they're actually working together. We'll get into what that's all about. And plus, we'll be taking your phone calls as well at 952-946-6205. Not right now, but a little bit later on the show. But first, lots of news out of Washington. And joining us now to talk about that is former Congressman Bob Ney, who's with Talk Media News. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Thank you. How are you?
I am fine today. We were chatting just before we got on the air that a lot of people were surprised about this lawsuit that the Democratic National Committee filed today against the Russian government, the Trump campaign, WikiLeaks, maybe some other people too we haven't mentioned here, but alleging a big conspiracy to disrupt the 2016 campaign and tilt the election to Donald Trump. This is what people have been talking about since the election. And here it is, finally, as a lawsuit. But this caught everybody by surprise, didn't it?
Well, it did, and this one really caught us by surprise, you know, with the media and the press pools, because, you know, frankly, look, you have consultants from both sides of the aisle. You usually hear things. You kind of call them up and say, is that coming? What's going on? This one didn't have that whole method of operation. There was sort of nothing, and a lot of people within the Democratic, you know, power structure, I think, didn't even know it's coming. It's a very fascinating suit because it's linking, so many people. And the Democrat National Committee, was the first major target, you know, as we know, of the Russian attack that happened. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz was head of the DNC at the time. And it kind of started with the attack of the DNC, which gives them a credibility to be able to file this anyway. But they added the really spicy part to it, and they are, you know, they're going after the Russian Federation, general staff of the armed forces of the Russian Federation. They are going after Guccifer 2.0, which was the pseudonym, you know, that was used over there. They're going after WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, Donald Trump Jr., Roger Stone, Paul Manafort, et cetera, and then they've got 1 to 10 John Does, who we don't know yet, and there's a reason, of course, they've got John Does. There's a reason we don't know those names yet. They've got to be, I mean, the other names are high power players, but they've got to be some fascinating people. I would assume people within the government structures, possibly even in the United States.
One of the reasons behind John Doe might be that maybe they don't know the name of the person, but they're hoping to get that name through doing exploration here, you know, trying to get more information, which I think is one of the points of the suit. I think, if I read this correctly, that this could possibly force Donald Trump to testify under oath, something that hasn't happened yet.
Well, that's true. I mean, it could potentially do that. People refer back to the fact that presidents don't necessarily have to, be part of suits, civil suits. But let's go back to Bill Clinton when the court ruled he had to, you know, testify in a suit against him. So if that happened with President Clinton, that could particularly happen with President Trump, where he might be compelled. Now, they can fight it, but he might be compelled to do that. I think the suit, like I said, is fascinating. Now, it's also going after the connection of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and also the Russians. Now, WikiLeaks has said over and over and over, you know, it didn't acquire information from Putin. But this is going to be interesting as to how, you know, they have to respond to this, or whoever filed this lawsuit, what do they actually know, you know, of these connections? Maybe they've got some ideas. Because wouldn't you think, Mike, for a second of, well, why was this filed now? Why not before? Well, potentially, and we don't know this, maybe they got additional information, a hot lead. Maybe they got some, you know, information sent to them that shows some connections that have been never known before this.
But none of that shows up in the lawsuit, per se. It's just most of this, what I was reading here, is stuff that we've known about. All the data kind of rolled up into one big wad here saying, yeah, here it is. This is real obvious. There's a conspiracy here.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And now, of course, this puts an economic face on this. It starts the lawsuit side of the approach. Everything's been investigative, you know, for a criminal up to this point. Now this is seeking damages. And again, you know, the first hack, as we know it, started with the Democratic National Committee, so makes pretty good sense that they would be the ones to go after this. I think this lawsuit's going to be fascinating. I want to see what the judge does with it. Does he let it proceed on? And, you know, the discovery on this one ought to be amazing.
Didn't we just, Trump allowed the, we'll get into the Comey memos here in a minute, but didn't Trump allow the Comey memos out because he found out he wasn't a target on this, and maybe this is a reaction to that, saying, okay, if we're not going to get you over there, we're going to get you over here?
Well, you know, for some reason, people in the White House and the Republican Party thought that the James Comey memos are really going to be helpful. They're going to be a great thing. Now, you know, a lot of times I think that, you know, Trump and the White House release things for their own brand at a certain time to get a press reaction, to get people off of other issues. You know, I'm a firm believer that that's done, you know, on purpose. On these Comey memos, I think they analyzed these, and for some reason they thought it would help. Now, if you read, you know, as I read through the memos, there's a lot of things that are said in these memos that, you know, are obviously very believable. The president would congratulate himself on the size of the crowd for his swearing in. You know, all these things that we've kind of known, right, as you read through them. But what's of interest on these, I think, from the Mueller investigatory angle is going to be, I'm sure he's reading through these, of, you know, was there any, in these conversations, obstruction of justice, which has always been an ongoing question and ongoing problem for the White House.
Now, Trump has lawyered up, obviously, several times, and he's been losing lawyers left and right. He got Rudy Giuliani, of all people, to sign up to his team. Would Giuliani be one of the people who's going to end up fighting this lawsuit then?
Well, I have a theory, and this is totally for me, and it's just because, you know, I've known some people that, you know, obviously we're involved in the Clinton campaign. I know a lot of people that were involved in the Trump campaign. And I think that Giuliani comes on not because of any legal expertise. I really don't think so. I think he comes on or has been brought on by somebody, maybe not even the president himself. Maybe the president agreed to it. But, you know, in the White House, you've got Don McGahn and others, you know, that serve as counsel to the president. I think they brought Rudy Giuliani on to somehow feel that he will be able to, and I'm going to use the word control, or manage the president, to try to get him to, you know, be quiet about a lot of these things that are, you know, under investigation. Because I don't know that Giuliani's got, you know, such an expertise he can do this or that. I mean, he's got background, don't get me wrong. I just have a feeling that he's been brought on more to try to do something about the president.
One of our listeners here wants to know if maybe this lawsuit is a fail-safe in case Mueller is fired. This is another way of keeping the pressure on and going forward. There's been legislation, you know, that would prevent him from being fired that just can't find its way to the floor. Maybe this was a reaction to that.
Well, that's really a great observation by the listener. I mean, that is a potential. Look, I do not believe, by any having served in Congress and knowing the Republican Party, I don't believe by any stretch of the imagination, I don't care if Lindsey Graham's supporting it or whatever, that they will ever pass something that will say the president cannot fire Mueller, or any president cannot fire somebody that conducts these special investigations. It's not going to happen. So if I was going to have a backup fail-safe, it would surely be this lawsuit versus trying to actually believe that the U.S. House and Senate are going to pass something on to the onto the president. So I think that's a better chance of what the listener wrote in than waiting for Congress to pass something.
We're speaking with former Congressman Bob Ney. He's with Talk Media News, and we're chatting about the big events happening in Washington, D.C. The other big piece of news here today is, of course, the Comey memos that came out. These are the memos that James Comey kept while he was still FBI director, and he was talking to Donald Trump. He'd make his notes afterwards because he was kind of uncomfortable with what was going on. So what did we learn about this? The headline said hookers and jailing journalists. Explain that, and what else was hanging in there?
Well, I mean, there's not a whole lot new in the sense of where you look at them and say, wow, did the president say that? You know, but
Putin,
I think it
said hookers.
Yeah, well, now that was because the documents renew attention to this whole strange, odd relationship, you know, that's been out there with Putin and Trump. And here's one thing I picked. The hooker part is a big deal on this because, you know, Trump has denied the salacious allegations that he watched prostitutes engage in lewd behavior, et cetera, you know, in Moscow. And then it goes on to say that, you know, Trump had told Comey about a comment, you know, that Putin made about, cheap hookers. Well, if that's accurate, that Trump said that, when in fact was he ever told that by Putin? Because he only had, you know, remember, was it the G5 where they met?
Mm-hmm.
And he denies he had contact during the election with Putin. So at what point in time did Putin tell him that? When they were at the G5 talking about economics, and he turned to the president and said, oh, by the way, hey, we have cheap hookers.
Well, that's a perfect venue to bring it up, isn't it? At the G5, everybody talks about hookers there, right?
Right. And some people would say all the governments are hookers. But the whole point is that, you know, this is kind of interesting. These aren't little things. This is something that, you know, Mueller's going to pick out and ask the question, well, when were you told that? I thought you didn't talk to, Putin. So, I mean, the more these things go on, the more fascinating. But I think that's one of the bigger things that that came out of these memos.
A salacious detail that might actually have some bearing on what's going on. That's interesting.
Right.
The other thing I mentioned, of course, was that Trump had talked about or inquired about jailing journalists, which to me, of course, just is like, that's way, way over the line. That's fascism. And again, this was the whole idea of trying to track down leaks in the government. I mean, has a president ever brought that up before? I mean, in your experience in Washington, D.C., going that far?
I have. I mean, I've racked my brain on this. I've actually, met seven presidents. I served under two terms of Bush and President Clinton, you know, and I've been reporting on President Obama. I can't even recall anything that ever got close to it, ever. So I think this is a brand new one, and it's interesting that you have a president making this conversation to an FBI director, because, look, to me, that brings back the chills and shades of J. Edgar Hoover.
Exactly.
Hoover blackmailed them all.
Another topic I wanted to touch on here is Syria. Obviously, it was a week ago that the United States bombed Syria, sent in the missiles. What's happened since then? Strategically, was it a blunder? Was it a success? Do we know anything?
Well, we know that, first of all, let's go to the fact that President Trump, who criticized President Obama, and at the time when I covered this for the media, I did feel that President Obama at some points in time was absolutely giving out too much information of, you know, some of his ideas and the strategies of the Middle East. It wasn't bad, but I felt, you know, maybe could keep some things a little bit more in the pocket. Now President Trump turned around and did exactly what President Obama, what he was mad at him for, and did it on steroids, President Trump. Anyway, here I come, we're coming, we're going to do this, which allowed Syria to make some movement of any potential chemical weapons to another location, number one. So now the four anonymous government sources, and when there's four, that's high level. Usually the press runs on two, right, Mike? Well, there's four. And they are saying that we just didn't achieve anywhere near what we're saying we did. Now, kind of the Machiavellian in me, because now we have John Crazy Man Bolton in the NSA, so the Machiavellian side of me tells me maybe even Bolton was part of this leak, because by leaking this and having Lindsey Graham complaining and some Democratic members, we don't have a plan on Syria. Then all of a sudden we say, well, we didn't get the job done. Not even a fourth of this was done, so we better continue to keep troops in Syria, and we better continue to do more bombing. So maybe that's potentially why some of that leaked, but no matter what, it wasn't as effective as we thought, and it wasn't as effective as United Kingdom and our allies are actually, you know, claiming on this. The other bottom line is, you know, what would be a strategy? John McCain and Lindsey Graham have always wanted President Obama and Trump to run into Syria, take care of the Iranians, get rid of the Russians, topple Assad, and then run the country. We tried that once in Iraq. You know, it wasn't very successful. So I just think that there is a scattered policy, but everybody kind of hung on to the bombings as a big deal, and now I think we're finding out it wasn't as effective as has been said.
Speaking about effective, last topic I wanted to hit with you. Of course, the Trump administration announced the tariffs with China, and China has retaliated. Sorghum, it's something we don't think about here, but it's a big, big industry in agricultural land in Minnesota and other states. And today, a ship headed to China with filled up with sorghum by Cargill here, one of our big companies in Minnesota, did a U-turn, is heading back because of those tariffs that China is putting on. Is the whole idea of this trade war going to backfire on Trump's base, which, you know, was a lot of the agricultural areas?
Well, you know, 21 ships carrying 1.2 million tons of sorghum are out there on the water. And, you know, more have turned around now by the time you and I, Mike, are speaking about this. It's a big deal. China is looking towards Australia for their sorghum prices. They won't be under the tariff law, so guess what? China gets, you know, sorghum what they used to get it at. We made the idea under the Trump administration, I think very statistically correct on this product, and, you know, the steel prices are inflated and aluminum coming in the country, we're going to put the tariffs. I think we really did that in a pretty methodical manner, right? The Chinese did it in a purely political base. They went into farmland that's hit here. I mean, they really did a precision surgery when they retaliated, and they did it within 11 hours of our first volley on this thing. So question is, what do we do next? It could backfire, but then again, because like I said, the Chinese really hit the political buttons. Then again, here's the dilemma President Trump has. Look, let's face the fact, Mike, that he secured at least three states that, you know, he couldn't have gotten normally. And he did it off of a lot of people on the Democratic side and union people switching over for him because of his position on trade issues, because he convinced people he was more like Bernie Sanders than Hillary Clinton, you know, on the trade issue. And people were suspicious. So that was what he did. Now, if he doesn't hold to what he's doing now, he will lose that entire base. If he holds to what he's doing, we're going to have a lot of pain to go through, but this first round is in the markets of ag, which is his base too on another, you know, arena. So I think that if he comes back and hits Chinese hard somewhere else, I guess maybe they will start to have negotiation and he wins on this. If not, and if he goes backwards on this, he's got a real problem. And no one said, you know, this would be easy. This has gone on so long, and we've been on the losing side. But right now, it just doesn't look like this is going to stop. And I think there's, you know, going to be a lot of pain along the way. If he can get to the farm part of this, he could have a win. If he can't, he's going to have a real problem with people in his own party.
We've been speaking with Bob Ney from Talk Media News. Bob, we got to run along, but I appreciate you checking in with us today and chatting about
all this stuff. Thank you for having me on the show. Thanks.
We're going to take a break, folks, but when we get back, we've got a couple of news notes I want to get into, and later on, we've got, Ralph Nader. That Ralph Nader, that's all ahead here on the Mike McEntee Show.
Turn to Auto Technical with your vehicle donation. Even though Auto Technical is a small nonprofit, we have helped more families with transportation than any organization in Minnesota. Since 1994, we have reconditioned donated vehicles so they have a higher tax benefit. Call Richard at 612-919-5526. 612-919-5526 or autotech.org.
Brending Electrolysis on Grand Avenue in St. Paul has been a leader in permanent hair removal for people of all skin types and backgrounds for over 30 years, celebrating diversity and priding themselves on finding the right treatment plan for each client's individual needs, regardless of race or gender. Services include electrolysis, body waxing, facials, microneedling, and permanent makeup. Book your 60-minute complimentary consultation, including a 15-minute treatment today, for beautiful, lasting results. Visit BrendingElectrolysis.com.
Did you know that tooth decay is the most common disease in America and that over half the American population has some form of periodontal disease? Simply brushing and flossing don't seem to be enough. The abundant bacteria in your mouth thrive off sugar to produce acid and plaque. But what if you could actually prevent bacteria from converting sugar into the harmful byproducts responsible for tooth decay and periodontal disease? Daily Dental Care is a life sciences company that leverages our microbiology expertise to create oral care products that promote strong teeth, healthy gums, and fresh breath. Our lozenges safely and effectively neutralize harmful bacteria and their disease-causing byproducts like acid and plaque, without harming health-promoting bacteria that guard your mouth against the destruction that sugar causes. Supplement your daily dental hygiene routine with our convenient dental lozenges. Go to dailydentalcareswithans.com or Amazon to purchase and use promo code DDC95001 at checkout for a 25% discount on your first purchase.
These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Daily Dental Care lozenges are not intended to replace daily dental hygiene practices.
Hey, welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show here on AM 950. Happy Friday to you. Reversal story here. Remember last week we were talking about an environmental victory in the Minnesota Senate? Senator Michael Goggin, a Republican from Red Wing, voted with the Democrats to defeat a bill in committee that would have given Enbridge a green light to build its pipeline in Minnesota with no review from the Public Utilities Commission. Now, this was a bill that Enbridge didn't ask for, is not sure that it wants, and that Governor Mark Dayton has threatened to veto. So when this went down, end of story, right? No, not so at the Minnesota legislature, where it's never over until it's over, and then sometimes it's still not over, as we've seen in the courts. Senator Julie Rosen, a Republican who missed last week's committee meeting, asked the same committee to reconsider the bill this week. It is essentially a do-over, and there was no public notice. And unlike the previous meeting, where there were a lot of angry citizens there to, you know, glare at them and let them know that this was something they didn't want to have happen, there were very few people or nobody there to witness what was going on. And so this time the bill passed 6-4 on a party line vote, with Senator Goggin flipping his vote. But remember, Governor Mark Dayton says he's going to veto this. One other environmental note. Oh, yeah. And by the way, PUC is expected to make its final decision on the pipeline in June. One other environmental note. Colin Peterson, Democrat from Minnesota, says he has the House on the House floor to pass a bill removing federal protection for gray wolves across the Great Lakes region. He just can't get it to the floor. His bill has co-sponsors with both parties in, you know, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan, has cleared the committee but remains in congressional limbo. The problem lies that the Republican majority rules do not allow a Democratic bill to the floor that is controversial. And so Peterson's been trying to get a Republican to take the bill over, but he can't find any takers. So right now, it stays on the endangered list. Well, coming up next, we're going to be speaking with Ralph Nader. Yeah, that Ralph Nader, the guy, the consumer protection guy, the once presidential candidate. And we've got lots of questions for him. And he's got a new show here on AM 950. We'll talk about that right after this week's Art Beat.
This is Art Beat for the Week. I'm Lori Fitz from Connections Radio Show. And today I want to share about the Spring St. Paul Art Crawl presented by the St. Paul Art Collective. It's going to be running April 27th, 28th, and 29th. And this is a must-do experience for all of you. This is something that you'll just love. There's 350 artists and 34 locations. And with me for Art Beat today, I have Don Dickinson, who created the King of the Road, which was selected as the cover photo for the Art Crawl catalog. Now, that catalog is being distributed around the Twin Cities now. To look for it, look for a picture of University Avenue with a stalwart biker biking in front of a big old bus, and it has a fractured quality to it. Don, tell us about this piece.
Well, I was out photographing a couple of years ago after a big snowstorm, sort of like we had last weekend, and in front of the Dow Gallery where I showed the pieces, there was this guy riding a bike coming down there right in front of the bus in about 10 inches of snow, and I thought that might make a really interesting painting. So one of the things I like to do is try and fracture the pieces to pick up some urban energy, and I was able to do that with this, and sort of that's the end result.
Has kind of an energy chaos going on, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. That's one of my things I like to do is take an urban sort of environment and fracture to bring some of that urban energy into the visual picture.
Now, you said this also combines a lot of different parts of your experiences, your interest in both photography and architecture and painting. Tell me more about that.
I was going to be an architect when I was a kid, so I went to architecture school, and then I had a friend who was into photography, and that got me kind of out of architecture off into photography. I went to Art Center College in Los Angeles for a while and did commercial photography down there for a while. Then I got tired of that and went back to art school and got back into painting, and sort of it's just a big brown mishmash that's essentially these late pieces encompass everything that I've been doing most of my life.
Well, another thing that I like about it is you said that it's not just a pretty composition. You're trying to get something more. Tell me what that more is.
Trying to get a raw slice of life, basically, kind of like Lee Friedlander, Gary Winogrand, these kind of New York street photographers. So everything isn't composed with a nice sort of, you know, the subject's at the one-third in, and it's a really lovely piece. I like more of a raw kind of approach, which kind of started back with Degas when he was doing photography and cutting off images at the edge and cutting off people and things like that.
So for you folks out there looking to do something next weekend, be sure to go to the St. Paul Art Crawl and look for the catalog. It's a light green and has this cool picture of a stalwart biker beating the bus. That's Art Beat for the Week. I'm Lori Fitz from Connections Radio Show, airing live Saturday mornings, 9 a.m. here on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Hey, Mike McEntee, back with you here on AM 950. You just heard the weather. This is so much better than last week or whatever we've been suffering through here for the last month. Today I was out driving, going, you know, I was running, doing some various things. Left my car in a parking lot for, several hours, came back out, was able to walk out just wearing a suit coat. And then I got into the car and I was driving, and it actually felt hot. I mean, the sun coming through the windows, it actually felt warm. I had to turn on not just the blower for the air, but a little bit of air conditioning today. It feels almost guilty after the last couple of weeks of what we've been through, considering what we've had and the cold weather and the snow. But yeah, I turned on the AC today in my car. So that's my official winter is over significant event. So
I've got rid of my jacket for the rest of the year. That's my thing.
That's your thing?
No jacket today. Yep. And probably hopefully not till October.
I still have my parka because I've been wearing the parka when I've been out biking. I made it through every darn day in April except for the blizzard day. I gave myself a mulligan for that day. But I've tried to bike all 30 days in April just to get myself going. And I've been wearing the parka. I won't wear the parka today. I won't need that. So that's the best thing. I am so glad that is done. Well, hold it. I'm flipping ahead. No, there. I don't see any snow or disgusting weather on the calendar. I mean, it has happened as late as May, but we do not have any, at least on the immediate agenda here. It being a very nice day today, was it helped. The turnout here down at the state capitol. More than 1,000 Minnesota teens were down at the state capitol today rallying for tougher gun control measures. The effort was planned locally by Minnesota Students for Change. It brought kids from about 70 schools across the state, including Twin Cities area schools, as well as Rochester, Faribault, and Duluth. Representatives from the Minnesota Youth Collective walked through the crowd offering voter registration forms, taking in an estimated 100 today, which is pretty good considering only about a quarter of the crowd is eligible to vote, said one of the workers. This, of course, was one of many gun control rallies planned across the United States today because this is the anniversary, the 19th anniversary. It doesn't seem like that long ago, but the 19th anniversary of the Columbine shooting, where so many people died. And since that happened, we really haven't had any major changes in gun laws here in the United States or in Minnesota. We saw just this week, we had Democrats here in Minnesota trying to bring up some sensible gun control law. Basically, let's do background checks. The numbers for background checks are off the charts. People think that's a great idea, and it's a great way to start, at least down the road here, to dealing with some of the problems we have, because not one thing is going to solve all of the problems. I think that is something we can agree upon. And every time that you hear, oh, background checks wouldn't have stopped this shooter, all right, fine, but it would have stopped a lot of domestic violence. It would have stopped this, it would have stopped that. People tend to get focused on just one or two data points as opposed to looking at the larger picture, which, yeah, this might actually help with. But when that was brought up, and again, it's, the Republicans, Governor Mark Dayton basically said the Republicans considered this dead the minute that anybody suggested that we do this. The minute that this was brought up, Republicans said, nope, it's just not going to happen. And the committee said, nope, we're not going to do anything about this. Republicans have complete control of the Minnesota legislature. But since nothing's happened on this, absolutely nothing has happened on this because the Republican majority just won't let there. We did have a hearing. We had one hearing, and then the bill was tabled. And there's been attempts to get that bill off the table. It's existing. There's bipartisan support, actually, for this, but that hasn't happened. So we're waiting here, actually, to talk to Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader will be with us in a few minutes, but I wanted to talk about that. Ralph Nader is going to be on regularly, not on this program, but on this radio station. His program's going to be airing at 6 a.m. and then again at 9 p.m. here on AM 950. It's part of we've really kind of upped we've changed up some of the folks that we have here on the air. Brett, we've made a couple of changes in the lineup, haven't we here? I'm still here, Matt's still here, Stephanie Miller's still here in the morning. We've got Tom Hartman, but some of the shows that are later at night and on the weekends, we've done some changing here too recently.
Yeah, so basically the important part to say is nothing has been canceled or anything. So basically on Mondays, Ralph Nader's show will air at 6 a.m., replacing the Democracy Now! Replay. You'll still be able to hear, of course, the first run of Democracy Now! Every weekday at 2 o'clock, but then at night, we'll air Ralph Nader's program again at 9 o'clock, and then essentially everything just gets bumped back an hour. So you can still hear David Pakman at 10 o'clock on Mondays, then the Devil's Advocate will be from 11 until 1 a.m. But important part, nothing's canceled. We just have some new programs that have been added.
Yeah, and if you couldn't follow all that, you can just go over to am950radio.com. We've got the grid there. You can see when the programs are going to be on. And, of course, if that change in time means you can't listen, well, heck, there's podcasts as well, too. So you can get the links for downloading and listening to podcasts when you have time to do that. I was just mentioning guns, talking about how we have a lack of any action here nationally or in Minnesota. Mark from Fridley wanted to chime in on that. Hi, Mark. How are you doing today? Happy Friday.
Hi, Mike.
To you.
Pretty good. Everybody have a good weekend. Enjoy the nice weather. Listen, I wanted to take it a little bit different spin because this was tax week. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about how much our country and our taxpayers spend on guns for war. Now, the budget for this year constitutes 61% of our incoming budget goes to the war industry. We spend more on guns and missiles than the next eight countries combined. So the average American taxpayer paid $3,500 out of their pockets for the war industry. And in addition to that, for all of the Republicans out there, I want to mention there is lists of hundreds of American corporations, including defense contractors like Boeing and General Electric, that didn't pay any taxes at all and haven't paid taxes for years, and in fact, get significant tax rebates. So I just want to run a couple of companies, you know, real quick for you. One is Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo didn't pay any tax, and they got a 20% tax break last year. So they got money back from the government. They didn't pay anything in. You got Priceline.com. You got Boeing. You got PG&E. You got General Electric. You got Facebook. Facebook didn't pay any taxes last year. They haven't. And they got a 40% tax rebate. Verizon, Qualcomm, ExxonMobil, International Business Machines, IBM. Here's another one. J.P. Morgan Chase didn't pay any taxes last year. Capital One Financial didn't pay any taxes last year. And I just want to clear something up, Mike, because we need to talk about Syria. And we need to talk why we have to commit so much of U.S. taxpayer money to weapons used around the world. And that was the fact that yesterday, in a congressional private briefing, the Secretary of Defense, Mad Dog Mattis, the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, and Rex Tillerson's replacement, whose name is escaping right now, for Secretary of State. So you got the three big dogs. You got the SecDef, you got the Secretary of State acting, and then you got the head of the DNI, said that the Trump administration wasn't able to provide any evidence of what the media and politicians have been telling people about Assad gassing his own people. And the person that came up with a alternate reality, which is more based on facts and being on the ground, was a journalist out of the United Kingdom. And he's something we don't have over here. He's an actual investigative journalist. He went to
We have investigative journalists here, but they're not. There's some great ones in the Guardian and the UK as well. So.
Well, this guy's name is Robert Fisk.
Okay.
And he confirmed in talking to medical doctors there. And again, I'm former military. Our training on nuclear biological chemical NBC is 80% of what we trained with and how to respond to that. And immediately, when I saw those pictures of these white helmets and first responders running around in clouds of gas without any protection, I knew immediately we were being all sold a bill of goods. If you think you have to put your oxygen mask in the event of a plane accident, you know, you these chemicals, if you ingest or get a micro dot on you, are terminal. And this Robert Fisk, and anybody can take a look and search his name, concluded and talked to medical doctors over there that, in fact, these people did die, but it wasn't because of gas. And we haven't been able to find any evidence with respect to blood evidence or body evidence. But what these people died of was asphyxia. They were hiding from the shelling in the buildings that were brought down upon them, and they suffocated. Hypoxia, lack of oxygen. And so when we talk about gun control, when we talk about taxes, when we talk about who's not paying taxes, we need to talk about getting out and demanding from our the politicians, and again, 92% of the Democrats, and thank God for Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders was one of the only people to stand up and denounce this, and also denounce what happened and has happened week after week after week after week that's not getting reported, and that's what the atrocities being committed against the Palestinians in Gaza.
It's just not a great situation. It is just not a great situation. Hey, Mark, thanks for the phone call. We got to roll on here, though. We're going to take a break here. But when we get back, we're hoping that we can have Ralph Nader. We've had a little bit of trouble getting in touch with him, but we're going to see if we can get him on here the show yet. So you're listening to the Mike McEntee Show. We'll be back in just a couple minutes. That's what I feel now.
On behalf of Zero Res, your home stinks. What, you didn't notice? Well, of course you can't smell it because you live there, but the stink is definitely there. That means it's time to call the pros at Zero Res to clean those puppy piddles and coffee spills, and your home will smell fresh and clean, not like a janitor's chemical closet. This month, get 3 rooms Zero Resified starting at $139. Plus, this month, save $50 when you get your air ducts Zero Res clean. Call 952-ZERO-RES or visit ZeroResMN.com. Zero Res. Spell it backward or forward, it spells the same.
Since Donald Trump and the Republicans took over Congress, our consumer protections have been under assault. One of the people fighting back is Ralph Nader. He is the host of a new program on AM 950, the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Mondays at 6 a.m. and 9 p.m. Ralph Nader is joined by co-hosts Steve Scroven and Dan Feldman for a lively, informative discussion on consumer rights and the political landscape. Now is a more important time than ever to stay informed about the push to roll back consumer protections. So tune in to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Mondays at 6 a.m. and 9 p.m. on AM 950.
At Pride Institute, being LGBTQ+ is the norm, not the exception. Their highly trained and skilled staff understand your issues and will help you live a happy, healthy life as a proud LGBTQ+ person. They offer you hope to overcome your addiction and live the life you want. Their treatment programs are designed to assist you in developing the knowledge, skills, and attitudes for long-term recovery. Therapy groups include health education, LGBTQ issues, HIV and chronic illness, trauma, grief and loss, transgender support, nicotine recovery, education, and sexual health. Pride Institute offers a residential treatment program, a partial hospitalization program that includes day programming with lodging, and an intensive outpatient program. If you or someone in your life can benefit from guidance and coping skills, life balance, and other tools necessary for long-term recovery, check them out at pride-institute.com or call 800-547-7433 now. Give it.
Hey, welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. Sulfide mining. We've talked about that. It's an issue that has split the Democrats in Minnesota's 8th Congressional District into those who favor the environment and those who want to mine and create jobs. Well, it's also an issue in Wisconsin. In July, Wisconsin is going to lift its 20-year moratorium on gold and silver mining. Marathon County, which is smack dab in the middle of the state, recently became the first county to pass an ordinance to regulate sulfide mining. And the ordinance not only has the support of environmentalists, but mining companies as well. We get more from Elizabeth Braun.
Wisconsin's moratorium on gold and silver mining will be lifted as of July, so a number of counties are now looking into creating their own mining regulations. Counties want to prevent or mitigate damage to well water and the environment after Governor Scott Walker decided new mines could attract business and help keep younger workers in the state. Last week, Marathon County became the first to pass an ordinance, and it's being held up as a model for others. County Board Chair Kurt Gibbs says officials spoke to environmental groups, mining companies, residents, and legal experts to figure out what could work for all.
Tried to strike a balance between the interests of mining and the interests of the citizens of Marathon County.
The ordinance requires mining companies to pay a $50,000 upfront deposit and put another $15,000 into a trust fund for every well that could potentially be affected by the company's actions. Lifting the 20-year mining ban was controversial in the legislature, with critics pointing out that mining can't help but cause environmental damage. This year, Sierra Club's Dave Bluen says the kind of mining that would occur in Marathon County would cause long-term damage, and it would be impossible for any county to draft an adequate ordinance to address the situation with only a few months before the state moratorium lifts. He says the environmental damage far outweighs the limited economic benefit.
The state has arbitrarily decided that metallic mining developments are a good economic driver. And from our standpoint, they're anything but. The industry hasn't proved its claims that it can mine and operate safely in metallic sulfide ores.
Mining companies say newer technology will minimize the risk of pollution. Marathon County has been identified as a potential target for mining. In 2014, a gold sulfide deposit was found in Easton near the Eau Claire River, but the company that identified it has no immediate plans to mine there. I'm Elizabeth Brown, Wisconsin News Connection.
Now, as we've been mentioning, AM 950 has a new show joining our lineup. Ralph Nader Radio Hour is going to be on at 6 a.m. and 9 p.m. And joining us to talk about it is none other than Ralph Nader. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Good to have you on here. People have been sending me questions, and I know we only got a couple minutes, but before we get into anything, I got to raise the question that everybody tosses me when your name comes up. They always talk about 2000, and you've written about this extensively, and you said that George Bush wouldn't have won the election even if you weren't running. I mean, he would have won the election, I said, in Florida, even if you weren't running, because your voters would have voted for him or not voted at all. Are people still mad at you about that? Do they still bring that up a lot? I mean, I'm obviously bringing it up. I got emails about it.
Well, it's scapegoating. The Democratic Party never wants to explain its losses by blaming itself. It has to blame others. And they have been unable to defend the country against arguably the worst Republican Party in Republican Party's history. It would have startled Teddy Roosevelt or Senator Robert Taft or President Eisenhower, these Republicans today. And so we really have to stop discriminating against small candidates. They are exercising their free speech and petitioning and assembling under the First Amendment, and they have as much right to run as anyone else. Having said that, people who express what you just summarized ought to talk to Al Gore. He knows that he won the popular vote in most countries. That would be enough. The Electoral College took it away from him, threw it into Florida. 300,000 Democrats in Florida voted for George W. Bush in 2000. And there were all kinds of shenanigans from Tallahassee to Washington with that political 5-4 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, blocking the Florida Supreme Court from completing its order for a full state recount. So you don't blame the Green Party, you don't blame the candidates for the Green Party for that. It's just plain scapegoating. And it's haunted the Democratic Party because they can never look at themselves in the mirror and say, why are we losing most of the state legislatures, most of the governorships? The three branches of government are under control in Washington of the Republican Party. Instead, they're looking for scapegoating, and third parties fill that bill for them. Shame.
One of our listeners, Dale, writes that he's frustrated about what happened to Bernie Sanders in the Democratic Party, and he wants to know if a third party should really be considered as an option. You've had experience there. What's your thoughts?
Well, I think he would have won the nomination. There were some bad undermining of his candidacy in Nevada and Iowa. He just barely lost formally, but some people think that there was fooling around with the votes, and he really won, and he then won the New Hampshire primary. So had he won the first three primaries, he would have had a momentum that would have been hard to stop. And, of course, he broke new ground in raising over $250 million in small donations, averaging $27 a donation. I mean, that was a great contribution all by itself. I think he was smart to run as a Democrat because that's the only way he could get into the primary debates and get wide media coverage. If he ran as a third party candidate, he would have been frozen out of debates, harassed in every state from getting on the ballot to give people more voices and choices, and in many ways not even polled. And he would have been in a vicious circle. So I think he was smart. And if he runs again, he'll definitely run under the Democratic Party banner. I'm certain of that.
Now, as we mentioned, you have a show that is going to be airing here on AM 950. It's going to be at 6 a.m. and 9 p.m. It's the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Great name, I guess, if it's Ralph Nader on there. What is the show about?
It's about putting people on who have accomplished great things but never gotten much news coverage, or who are in the process of doing that to better the country, or who have good proposals to do that. And most of the progressive radio programs around the country have to key into the current headlines. And so if Fox creates some sort of scandalous story, the progressive program will give the other side of the story. But it's trapped by today's headlines. The Ralph Nader Radio is not trapped by today's headline. It shows what people are doing to establish a better economy. For example, the consumer co-op movement, the food co-op movement, which is most active in the Minnesota area, especially Minneapolis, St. Paul. There are more food co-ops there than any other place of comparable population in the country. I just had on the former head of the Internal Revenue Service, John Koskinen, where he was freer to talk about the Republicans so cutting the budget to the bone of the IRS that they keep people on the phone for hours. People can't get through. They just don't have enough people. They have 20,000 less people than they had 10 years ago, and they have 10 million more taxpayers. And as a result, the IRS can't collect about $450 billion in uncollected taxes. So he was able to talk more candidly about that. We had the former mayor of Richmond, California, 110,000 people, mostly low income, Hispanic, African American, and they turned the city around and upward progress in so many ways, taking on the giant Chevron refinery, reducing its pollution, making it pay a little bit more share of its taxes. They had a higher minimum wage enacted. They just improved the quality of life. Well, most people don't know about that. It never gets on.
It doesn't. And Mr. Nader, unfortunately, we are out of time here, but I appreciate you joining us. Again, the show is on at 6 a.m. and 9 p.m. here on AM 950. I'm Mike McEntee. We'll talk to you next week.